cooperation. Finally, we do not agree on the way to handle the media. I feel distance and honesty and non-manipulation is the way to go. You want to control or handle or humor the press. That is not how we run the company. We are the media. I do not think your instincts in this company towards the media is the way to play it. And your bad press is not John Dreyer's fault. Where does that leave us? I think we should part ways professionally. I believe you should resign. And my concern now is that we end this as soon as possible and do it hopefully in a way which best protects you in the public eye. I had hoped Sony would have afforded you the opportunity, but it did not work out. I do want what is best for you. You have to decide that, but I can assure you that I would like to remain friends, that I will be supportive and positive, and I will work together with you to accomplish what has to be done promptly. Michael. Eisner sent the letter to Sid Bass, Irwin Russell, and Sandy Litvak, but not to Ovitz. After conversations with the board members that I sent it to, we felt that it was pushing it. It was overly histrionic. It was too mean, Eisner later explained. It also meant that Ovitz had no chance to respond to any of the allegations. The Ovitz situation was so distracting that Eisner had little time to savor Disney's considerable successes. For all the distractions in the executive suite, it was testimony to the depth of talent at the company that movies got made, television shows produced, and new theme park rides conceived. The summer's animated film, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, crawled across the $100 million mark by Thanksgiving 1996, just when the Disney studios kicked off the holiday season with 101 Dalmatians, which had been completed on a budget of $45 million, even with high-priced talent like Glenn Close and John Hughes involved. Though most critics savaged the effort as a pointless remake of the animated original, Close's performance drew praise, as in the Los Angeles Times. Played with great style and enthusiasm by Close, and costumed to perfection by Anthony Powell, Cruella vamps around in outlandish outfits that include the spikiest heels, a stretch limo version of a cigarette holder, and elaborate gloves with fingernail claws. But her zest for lines like, "I live for fur. I worship fur," cannot surmount the great wall of blandness that muffles this movie like a cocoon. More to the point, the film did $136 million in domestic box office and unleashed an avalanche of plush dogs and other merchandise. Disney promptly began work on a sequel. In its first crucial test, Roth's event strategy was vindicated. Ovitz was nominally in charge of the studio and thought he got none of the credit. He thought the success of Dalmatians might buy him a little more time. His latest plan was to use the Christmas holiday, when their families would be together in Aspen, to spend time alone with Eisner and convince him to change his mind. He started work on an elaborate presentation that would highlight his achievements during the year he'd been there, the initiatives he had underway, and the ways he planned to address Eisner's concerns in the future. His wife, in particular, had encouraged him not to give up. Her advice was I should beat all these people and stay there and not lose my long-term point of view. She was dead set against me leaving.